Educause is pleased to provide you this coverage of the 2005 Seminars on Academic Computing Conference. In this recording, we'll listen in on Charles Vest, President Emeritus of MIT, as he shares his thoughts on open courseware and the emerging global meta-university.
Thank you very much, Vijay. When I announced that I was stepping down as MIT's president, one of my colleagues said to me, "Well, that means you've now reached a stage in your career where you can give speeches and write about all the things that are wrong with American higher education that you didn't fix when you could have." So it's kind of in that spirit that I'm in front of you today. And I do want to say that the things I want to talk about today are really a very personal view. In terms of the details of what I'm going to talk about, the vast majority of you know more than I do, but I'd like to tell you how I think about it. Just to set a little context, about a year ago, the Times of London Higher Ed Supplement did yet another one of these big surveys of universities, in this case all around the world, and attempted, according to a set of criteria, to rank them. And I got a call from the editor of the supplement who said, "Look, of the top five universities, as we rank them, four of them are in the United States. And of the top 10, you see all but seven of the top 10 are from the U.S. Why do you think this is, and would you write a little piece explaining why?" And I wrote a little piece that said, here are some of the attributes of U.S. higher education that I believe are enormously important and that others might seek to emulate, improve upon, modify, what have you. But I think these are among the key factors that make our system of higher education great. First and foremost is the diversity of institutions, by which I mean everything ranging from small liberal arts colleges to big Midwestern land-grant institutions to more specialized places like Caltech and MIT and all across the gamut. Second, freedom for young faculty. Our system allows young men and women who join our faculties pretty much to pursue whatever it is they want in scholarship and teaching. We seriously do interweave teaching and research in our research universities, and we very much mean that. It's not just something we pay lip service to. We have gained great strength, a point I will come back to, from our decades upon decades of openness to students, faculty, and scholars from other countries. We have an implicit national science and technology policy that has pretty much bipartisan agreement that there is a very important role of the federal government to support research in our institutions, and therefore particularly graduate education. We have a spirit of philanthropy to both our public and private universities that is unmatched anywhere else in the world. And even though many of us think they are imperfect, we actually have a set of tax laws that help to encourage that. And finally, while it's the bane of existence of any administrator, the fact is that competition for the very best faculty and students keeps us sharp. Now, the reason I'm starting with this is I picked three words out of what I just said: diversity, interwoven, and open, because I think these are characteristics that, through the kind of information technology you all are engaged in and its role in education, we are able to generalize today in some sense on a worldwide basis. Now, while I'm not exactly going to give you my answer to all of these, I'll give you at least a perspective, the questions we worry about constantly, how will education technology play out in the long run, what will be the nature of globalization of higher education, this sort of next generation, if you will, of university presidents that's following mine. This is maybe the number one thing they're all thinking and worrying about. Will the internet fundamentally reshape higher education? I'd argue that it already has, to more depth than many like to admit. And are residential universities dinosaurs or the continuing wave of the future? I'll give you my brief answer. They're the continuing wave of the future. Now, my EdTech nightmare. If you go back 5 or 6 years when the dot-com bubble was out there and all the schools were trying to figure out what to do beyond their own borders, the nightmare image I had was exactly what many people were promoting. Namely, for each course, let's go find the best person in the world and let's video his or her lectures and let's get them out there on the web and sell them. And my nightmare is students all over the world sitting in front of a box viewing exactly the same lecture. That goes against all three of the points I raised a moment ago, particularly openness and diversity. So an alternative that my faculty and staff colleagues at MIT conceived in a rather interesting way, I must admit, is our open courseware initiative, which is to be the core of what I want to talk about today, but only the core. The concept, as you know, is very simple. It's to make the basic teaching materials for just about all 2,000 subjects we teach at the Institute available on the web to teachers and learners everywhere, free of charge. And I cannot say this enough. Vijay and I were talking about it last night, remembering back to the early days when we announced this. This is a form of publication. It's not really a form of teaching or distance learning in the normal sense of the word. But above all, it is an adventure. Now, how did all of this come about? Well, I could give you the long version, but the short version is our provost, Bob Brown, had appointed a group of faculty and staff, a few other stakeholders engaged, to try to answer the question every institution was asking a few years ago, which is there a big thing that we ought to be taking? Is there a new role for MIT in distance learning, educational technology in some domain? And to make a long story short, they came to the conclusion with some outside consultant help, as a matter of fact, came to a conclusion that in the kind of higher education that MIT is engaged in, that that distance education would be highly competitive, it would be very complicated, and it would be very unlikely to make money for the institution. So at some point, somebody around the table said, well, if we can't make money on it, why don't we give it away? And this is one of these, I'm not going to quite call it random because there was more intelligence behind the comment than that, but it was one of these sort of catalytic thoughts that the group began to build on. And pretty soon Bob Brown came to me and said, well, my job's to tell you that the group's ready to report, but I'm supposed to find out if you're ready to receive the report, because what they want to do is give away all our basic teaching materials. And for once in my life, I instantly recognized a good idea. It usually takes me several months and a lot of convincing. And the reason is that I look back and remembered that in the late 50s and through the 60s, MIT had launched what most of us in the business call the engineering science revolution. It had a history that grew out of the Rad Lab, the radiation lab that developed and hardened radar during World War II, that came with a new way of thinking about teaching and practicing engineering with a strong science base under it. And all of a sudden, across the whole institution, people were writing new textbooks and they were putting materials together. And the people who were there, and in those days they were almost exclusively men, took those notes and took the new labs that were being developed and so forth, and they spread out across the country and became professors at other institutions. And it wasn't so much the formal textbooks that came later as it was porting those materials across the country. And then, of course, as you know, Stanford and Illinois and Michigan, many places picked up, joined in, and pretty soon the whole level of engineering education in the U.S. had been raised. And so I had been a recipient of this from a distance because I was an undergraduate at West Virginia University and did my graduate work at Michigan, no MIT connection. But those faculty, those materials, had a lot to do with what I learned in those other institutions. And so it suddenly dawned on me that what was being proposed, although there wasn't such an intellectual revolution under it at this point in time, was very much that same thing, but making it available relatively instantaneously through the power of the web, and also removing the randomness of, well, I happen to hire a professor from this institution, and he or she brought these materials along. So it simply seemed to me that it was a very beautiful and natural use of the internet and the web, and very much in the spirit of things that the MIT faculty had done over the years. And we were very fortunate that both the Mellon Foundation, and particularly Bill Bowen, and the Hewlett Foundation instantly saw this as an outstanding idea, but also, believe me, as something that might launch a movement or a new way of thinking about educational information. So we were very fortunate that they jumped in and have paid a lion's share of the cost of development and early operation of OCW. Again, I want to come back to this point. It was very important initially, particularly when parents started calling up and said, what do you mean I'm paying $34,000 and you're giving it away on the web? Is to recognize that in nobody's view does OCW constitute an MIT education. As Larry Bacow, the president of Tufts, at that time chancellor of MIT, said, a university education is not a box of books. And this was a very important statement because what gave the MIT faculty with almost, I would not say 100%, but almost uniform enthusiasm, allowed them to commit themselves to this, was it really was a statement. This is how we organize things. This is how we think about it. We are happy to put that out there and let people use it or not use it as they see fit. But we know that what we do on campus and the magic among these 18 and 19-year-old kids and engagement research and so forth is what really comprises the fullness of an MIT education. Now, I said OCW was an adventure, and I've made that statement many times, so when I put this particular talk together, I decided to look in the dictionary at what an adventure is, an exciting or extraordinary event or series of events, an undertaking involving uncertainty and risk, the participation or willingness to participate in things that involve uncertainty and risk, a risky or speculative financial undertaking. So OCW is indeed an adventure, but where is it leading? I would love sometime to talk for an hour about some of the ways in which we have learned that people are using these materials that we put out there on the web. We did not know. Believe me, and that's the excitement of the whole thing. Just a few examples. We have students at peer universities augmenting their learning, looking at a different perspective, a different set of problems, and so forth. We heard from a group of then unemployed Silicon Valley programmers who were mastering advanced languages in order to upgrade their skills. We know that a university in Ghana is using materials, this happens to be in computer science, to benchmark and revise their curriculum. And notice, they're not saying we're taking this and teaching it. They're saying we're using this to look at what we do, measure it against it, add to it, and so forth. It's that dynamism and flexibility that is important. My absolute favorite, there is an underground university with around 1,000 students in a Middle Eastern country educating a religious minority which is not allowed to attend institutions of higher education. And they're basing this primarily, not exclusively, but primarily on OCW materials. We've heard from a professor in Baghdad who is basing his research on data that is presented in one of our AeroAstro subjects. So the point is, openly accessible resources can be used in their entirety, they can be used in part, they can be used at any pace. They can be added to, deleted from, and modified to fit a teacher's, or I really should say a teacher's or learner's, purpose and context. So this is not about us saying, here's what and how you should learn. It is a starter set, if you will. What's the business plan? Well, I think we should just move on, because the fact is, folks, there is no business plan. This has, as I indicated, been funded by, primarily at least to get started, by these two generous foundations. MIT does take on a responsibility of either providing or finding the funds to maintain and sustain it once we've jumped in. But for those of you who are a little more pragmatic, which I hope is all of you, about 70% of MIT's on-campus students make relatively heavy use of the materials on OCW's website to review subjects they took in the past, to reinforce subjects they're currently taking, to explore other areas of study. Well, just three or four slides here that I borrowed from our amazing director of OCW, Ann Margulies, just giving a little sense of the scale of usage at this point. And when I say at this point, we're around halfway toward our goal of 2,000 subjects. But you can just see, here's the traffic, just it's a crude measure, simple web hits since 10.103. This was put together a few months ago. And you will see, not too surprisingly, that the dominant usage is in North America, in the U.S. and Canada. But it's spreading everywhere. It's used in Asia, the Middle East, even Africa, China and India, Australia, South America. Maybe a little slightly more sophisticated look at things. Here's 1 month's worth, February 2005, of all the hits from outside the U.S. You'll see India and China, not too surprisingly, are dominating, but they're just countries all over the place where people are at least exploring and hopefully utilizing this. Now, one of the agreements, and it's absolutely the right agreement with our initial funders, was to do a lot of instrumentation. So the people really directly engaged in OCW, you know a lot about how and where and why it is being used. We have a lot of pop-up surveys. We get, by the way, remarkable rates of response to those surveys. But I'm really proud of my colleagues with this. Look at this. I would recommend OCW to others, 92.5%. And we're in the 80% for all of these basic kind of questions. It helped. It improved my courses if I'm a teacher. Increased my motivation and interest in learning. So it is on some scale accomplishing the kind of things that we hope to use. Generally, our visitors to the site are fit one of three categories. They're educators, they're students, they're self-learners. This becomes a little complicated because there are, as you'll hear in a minute, there are mirror sites that take this in and spread it out. We don't have quite the same measure of that. Two-thirds of the visitors have bachelor's or master's degrees, so this tends to be a pretty sophisticated bunch, although we know lots of high school usage as well. They're most frequently interested, not surprisingly, in electrical engineering, business physics, and mathematics, but everything is, in fact, explored at some level. They review about a little less than 10 HTML pages per visit, come around once or twice a month. Without going into a lot of detail, there are, as we had hoped, beginning to be other OpenCourseWare initiatives follow on. And when I use that term, I mean major institutional commitment. Of course, there are a zillion individual course and group websites up, but these are things where institutions or parts of institutions have taken and shaped and put this up in a really good form with common look and feel and so forth. So we've seen here Utah State University, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. There's a university in India, Rai University, that's going into this in a big way. There is a not-for-profit called Universia, which ties together 840 universities in Spanish-speaking parts of the world. They have, to this point, translated about 100 of the subjects into Spanish, and will continue working on that. The largest thing we know about is in China, who has formed CORE, the China Open Resources for Education, that links 100 member universities in the PRC with 10 to 20 million users. And they're making heavy use of MIT OCW materials, but also translating those into Chinese and using them, but also mounting some of their own subjects, and in particular things like Chinese language and so forth that they hope will be useful to other parts of the world. So the kind of basic question I think about but don't really know the answer to is, what will this evolve to over a decade? Will it be replicated by other institutions? Well, the answer to that is already yes. It's not a gigantic movement, but it is a growing movement. Will it be replaced by other developments? Presumably in time it will be. Like everything else, it should be dynamic. But I think the really interesting question is whether at some point this will begin to grow sort of Linux-like into a single entity that is being contributed to and modified by people all over the world. I don't know the answer to that, because the moment MIT's goal is to keep our head down and meet the commitment that we originally made. Ann tells me that there are 30 known OCW-style substantial initiatives. They are in the U.S., in China, France, Spain, Portugal, and Brazil. She knows of about 30 more that have contacted us, because part of the openness is to share the things that we have learned about how to go about this, what problems to expect, and so forth. She knows about another 30 more, including some that are just about to come online in South America, the UK, and in Russia. There are many examples, many of which you have been leading or engaged in, of other kinds of open resources for scholarship and education. I'm mentioning just a few that I happen to have some level of knowledge about. Obviously, one of the big moves in the last year or so is the Google Library Initiative. I think some sometimes underestimated precursors of all of this, and very important for certain kinds of scholarship and certain kinds of institution, were the various things that have come out of the Mellon Foundation, starting with JSTOR, moving into ArtStore, and now a new organization that has spun out called Ithaca, some of you know about. There are many other kinds of open content initiatives and open academic software initiatives. So just looking very quickly across these, as you know, cooperating with Google are Harvard, Michigan, the New York Public Library, Oxford, and Stanford. And their goal, taken from their own website, is simple. It's to digitally scan books from these collections so that users worldwide can search them in Google. JSTOR, as I suspect you all are aware, makes available digital copies of scholarly journals in the liberal arts and the humanities. It does have membership fees. They are scaled to institutional size. It currently serves about 2,300 institutions and has in its digital collection over 400 journals. And like OCW, this has been a very empowering thing. It's allowed small colleges to either link together or individually work in areas that they simply could not afford to do otherwise. And now ArtStore is following in its wake, with a lot of leadership from Neil Rudenstein and others, to make available very high-quality digital images of great works of art. Framework is very similar to that of JSTOR, goal of about 5,000 such images by next year. Ithaca is a bit newer. It has a three-pronged mission: to incubate new projects, to provide some level of shared services for institutions, and also what I've called experiential networking, that is, helping people in various institutions and locations around the country and world learn from each other to move up that learning curve more quickly. Examples of current projects: Aluka, which is gathering scholarly resources from the developing world, starting with Africa, dealing with things like plants in Africa, cataloging them, providing images and so forth, and also working to gather together in cooperation, in partnership with people in South Africa, the sort of literature of the freedom movement in South Africa. There is eArchive that you're aware of for preservation and continued access to scholarly literature that was published electronically to begin with. And then NIDL, faculty staff development, shared resources, interinstitutional curriculum development in small colleges and community colleges and so forth, but with an emphasis on smaller liberal arts colleges. Many open academic software for as platforms and pedagogical tools, Sakai, OKI, the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie Mellon, Rice's Connection, Berkeley's excellent work in digital chemistry, Tufts, Penn State. I've underlined all the institutions just to point out that there are a myriad of you who are now getting engaged one way or another in open access materials. Other open educational content initiatives. Harvard Library is doing one. Sophia of Foothill De Anza Community College in California. Monterey Tech undertaking some very impressive work in National Repository of Online Courses. The America West calculation at UCal. The Alexandria Archive. And just many, many others. So the point is a lot is happening out there. So kind of thinking of archiving, which is a simple concept, but archiving and beyond, there are many things going on. DSpace, led initially by MIT, whose goal is somewhat different than these other things. It's to try to capture and archive the total scholarly output of individual institutions. There's the Million Book Project of Raj Reddy and his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon and collaboration with OCLC. And open courseware goals, as I have tried to point out, are different than, but not unrelated to, archiving. I think of them as much more flexible, much more agile, and to be used very differently than simple archived materials. But there is one thing that I've been thinking about a little bit. I haven't thought anything profound, but something to think about. And that's the amazing growth of portable memory. If you look at, and admittedly there are just a few data points at this point, but the memory in an iPod is starting to follow a curve just about like Moore's Law. So in 2004, for $400, you could get 20 gigabytes. About a year later, for roughly the same amount, you can get 60 gigabytes. And if you really extrapolate this by 2025, if you believe such extrapolations, for the same amount, you might get 40 petabytes. Imagine what that means. And so it does strike me that this could alter the mechanism for delivering materials like this, and I think this is something a lot of bright people need to think about and be prepared for. Another kind of extension that I have to admit being in love with is the brainchild of my wonderful colleague Jesus Del Alamo in electrical engineering and computer science at MIT, which is iLab. Now, the idea is very simple. If you have experimental apparatus that is controlled by computer, which is just about all experimental apparatus today, then that, in turn, can be accessed through the web, and you can run it remotely. Not a new idea at all in the research community. People have been doing collaborative work of this sort for a long period of time. But it's a pretty fresh idea, to the best of my knowledge, for educational use. So what he's been doing is developing with his colleagues an open architecture with a little bit of coupling, maybe ultimately more coupling to OCW, to allow people to run experiments, not simulations, but real experimental apparatus from a laptop. This started as an on-campus initiative, by the way, so that kids could sit in their dorm room at night and run an experiment. And the early things are the kind of things that are easy in that sense to do, characterization of electronic materials and components. But we've even got things like heat exchanger experiments and vibrational dynamics and so forth. And he's begun to link up with places all over the world to run experiments. If you can read the fine print, you'll see Singapore, Sweden, Greece, Taiwan, Uganda, Italy, as places where we are beginning to have people running small experiments at MIT. And I'm particularly excited about the work that he has been doing with a group of four institutions in sub-Saharan Africa, where under normal circumstances they could not begin to afford the kind of sophisticated apparatus that we're blessed with in this country. But by using a simple laptop, they are able to run experiments. It's really very exciting. This is just embryonic. It's definitely a work in development. There are other people starting to play in this space as well, as we would certainly hope. But my point of this slide is that the purple bars, or however they come up there, sort of red-orange, along the bottom are use of our own MIT students, and you'll see the dominant use already is from students outside MIT. Now, carrying my personal perspective a little farther, allow me an editorial comment. I believe that it is important more than any time in recent history that we pay attention to openness today. This is just a little reminder. U.S. visas issued to high-skilled visitors. Look before and after 9/11. There is a very complicated story to be told here. We all know bits and pieces about the difficulties. That's the subject for a whole lecture. But it is very important that we maintain policies in the United States that keep us open to these wonderful students and staff and faculty and visitors that come from all over the world to our nation and our campuses. Uh-oh. Is my time up? All right. I know somebody that once had a heart attack while speaking to 700 doctors, so this is a little similar. All right. Now. So that is sort of topically why openness is particularly important. But more strategically and fundamentally, the true spirit of education and democratization and empowerment requires our global openness. It's the underpinning, I believe, of innovation and cooperation and competition worldwide, and sharing and accessing expensively and intellectually intensive materials is important. But I also want to point to a term we don't use a lot in our business, which is public diplomacy. Why the U.S. needs public diplomacy today? The Pew Research Center recently asked 17,000 people from 16 countries the following question. Suppose a young person wanted to leave this country and ask you to recommend where to go to lead a good life. What country would you recommend? So you're living in country A. Somebody says, if you were to leave this country to have a good life somewhere else, where would you go? Out of those 16 nations, only one gave the United States as their top answer. That was India. And this is a slightly busy slide, but across each row is the percentage of people from the country in the column on the left who recommended U.S., Canada, Australia, U.K., Germany, and so forth. This would not have looked that way 10 years ago. The openness we take for granted in our institutions, the open flow of students, scholars, and faculty, but also the open flow of scientific, scholarly, and educational knowledge across our national and campus boundaries. I believe we owe to this flow of scholars much of our excellence, our cultural richness, our economic success, and in a very real sense of the term, our long-term national security. But the open flow of scientific information, which is also challenged in various ways today, is exceedingly important. Because science thrives only through unfettered communication. Just look what happened to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. They certainly had more than their share of brilliant scientists, but you can't live in isolation. Science has always had an international culture, and it requires constant criticism, testing, and repetition by others. And now I think we should begin adding to that the open flow of educational and scholarly resources. This is not new. People have always had textbooks, they've always had journals, they've always gone to conferences. But what is new, in my view, because of the growth of the internet and the web, is that we can think in terms of absolutely unprecedented scope and reach and speed of delivery of such materials and such communication. There's also a changing context, and this has a little science and engineering bias toward it. Where are the students today at the university level? Here is the year 2004, where in various parts of the world, what number of first degrees in science or engineering were earned. Asia is beginning to dominate by a long distance. Here you see Asia, Europe, and North America. And remember, the European population base and the North American population base are roughly comparable. So particularly in engineering, we're a small part of the community today in terms of sheer numbers of first degrees, bachelor's degrees entering the field. Looked at country by country, what you see is the absolute remarkable growth of China. There's never been anything like this. Terms from 1985 to about 1996, about 2000 rather, look at the growth of the number of bachelor's degrees in science and engineering. And at the doctoral level in science and engineering fields, the same trends are growing with roughly a 10-year time lag. So again, you see China climbing up very, very rapidly, already surpassing the UK and Japan. So where in the world students are is very, very different. I want to just point out in a very efficient way some important movements just by quoting two well-known book titles. Tom Friedman's The World is Flat and Henry Chesbrough's Open Innovation. What's the message of Friedman's book, The World is Flat? It's his view, in my opinion, a pretty accurate view of what globalization is all about, what's happening. And Chesbrough's book, Open Innovation, is about the new style of global partnering. The message of the first is it doesn't matter where you are. You can do much of today's work in Bangalore as easily as you can in San Francisco or where have you. The basic message of Open Innovation is that even in the corporate world, companies are now going to the best sources wherever they are, even in competitors' companies, and working much more in partnership, much more collaborative, and integrating the best regardless of where in the world it is found. So what about the globalization of our own domain, higher education? What is the future that universities have to think about? Do they want to open branch campuses? Is it about exchange programs? Is it about a few universities dominating teaching electronically around the world? Is it about forming various electronic learning communities? I think, of course, all of the above. But what we really need to be thinking about are these factors of scale, the diversity of context, and the distribution of resources. We can't, as individual institutions working one-on-one with branch campuses and so forth, really respond to scale, diversity, and distribution of resources. So to put a bottom line to all this, this is my personal view of what is really starting to go on with open courseware movements, with digital archives, with labs at a distance, all the kind of things we've been talking about. I think we're observing the early emergence of what I like to call a meta-university, a transcendent, accessible, empowering, dynamic, and communally constructed framework of open materials and platforms on which much of higher education worldwide can be either constructed or enhanced. What is important about this to me is that it will enable, in my view, not replace residential campuses. It will actually strengthen them. It will bring cost efficiencies to institutions through shared development. We can't do it all ourselves. It's too expensive. And very important, it will be adaptable, not prescriptive. And that's a flavor I really wanted you to take away from things like OCW. It's adaptable. It doesn't say this is how you have to do it. We will serve both teachers and learners directly. We will speed the propagation of high-quality education and scholarship. We will build bridges across cultures and political boundaries. And if I could say one thing that I deeply believe, this is going to be of particular importance to the developing world. This is really going to enable some countries in their educational systems to come up the curve much faster than they could have otherwise. In closing, I really want to thank many MIT colleagues, some of whom are listed here, many of whom are not. Also, the group at both the Mellon Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation that have believed in OCW and have also enabled a large swath of the open movement in many other dimensions. And most importantly, all of you and your colleagues around the country who in a very real sense make all of this possible. Thank you very much. What are you going to do here? Sure. Vijay's asked me to take a few questions. He said if I'll take them, he'll answer them. So.
I'm Bob Reynolds from UVA, and I have two quick questions. I'm sure you have easy answers. A, how in the world did you corral your faculty so that they would turn out these materials and maintain them? And second, how did you get past the copyright laws?
Boy, you know the right questions to ask. And I will try to answer them in a little bit of detail because they're very important. First of all, at MIT, as at any great university, the faculty only does what the faculty wants to do. So the role of people like myself and our provost, Bob Brown, many others, when you work to put together a large initiative like this, a lot of what you have to do is sell and engage the faculty in evolving the idea. And I want here to give particular credit to Bob Brown, who was our provost at the time all this was launched. First of all, the idea basically came out of a faculty committee. It was really a bottom-up concept. When I had the sort of external role of visiting the foundations, and it became pretty clear that if we put this into good form, we would get it supported, the provost, our chancellor, Phil Clay, some of the key faculty like Steve Learman, and in particular, but Hal Abelson, Dick Yu, they formed teams and visited every department at MIT. Visited every department at MIT for an open discussion of what we wanted to try to do and to get their view back. Now, this is worth a good article sometime because one of the things you learned was the difference in the cultures across the schools. By and large, and I'm exaggerating, but by and large, engineering instantly got this. It was the kind of thing they've done in many other ways. The Sloan School of Management said, we've already got almost everything up on the web anyway, count us in. The Humanities Arts and Sciences School was actually, I would say, Vijay, the most enthusiastic. Most enthusiastic. Science took a lot of convincing. But nonetheless, we all worked through it. And what were the counterarguments? What came back? I can't tell you how proud I was of the faculty, because our immediate concern was what everybody outside also was worried about or suspected would happen, was they'd say, we don't want you to have our IP. We're going to write a textbook. Why should we put it out there for free? I would say that argument came back from maybe 1% of the faculty. It wasn't much on the radar screen. There are a few examples. There are even a few examples where they had a good argument about that. By and large, that wasn't it. Number one concern, 50, 60% of the faculty, was, will we be able to do something of a quality that we'll be proud of? Number two, which was also the right argument, was, you guys in the administration over the last 4 or 5 years worked really hard to put some serious funds together for innovation and teaching on campus. You cannot cannibalize that to feed this new program. And the last one, which also had a lot of currency and is absolutely right, is, this can't just be a big add-on workload for us. We've got to have the support to do it. So that, in a nutshell, is kind of the faculty response, and there was sort of a two-step iterative process to gain the buy-in. But it is still a volunteer activity, and there are a few people who don't engage. Now, what happened is absolutely predictable. Once you begin to get everything up in this sort of uniform format, it's really useful. And we employ a lot of students to help them do this and so forth. So it's kind of been a win-win situation in my view. Now, the tough one is the intellectual property. And the short answer is that the biggest unfortunate expense we have has to do with third-party IP. It's when a professor puts together his or her course notes and borrows a figure from this textbook and that journal and pastes it in. We all know the ground rules are well known if that's just them teaching their course. When you put it up for the whole world, it's a different deal. And so a lot of the expense goes to very careful staff work to be sure we catch everything that is in fact copyrighted and so forth. There are very different rules that govern things that are, in the eyes of the law, creative literature and so forth and so on. Most things that we deal with in science and engineering are representations of physical phenomena, charts, things, photographs, things like that. Those, as bizarre as it sounds, if all else fails, you redraw the graph and use a different color and stretch it this way a little bit in its plan form. It's that ridiculous. Sometimes that's what we had to do. The real issue, though, is, and this is my simple-minded way of thinking about it, message I tried to get out to publishers is, you know, when you go to the movie and you see a can of Coke on the coffee table in a scene, Coca-Cola's paid millions of dollars to get that. It's the world's greatest free advertising. What could be better than all these people out there seeing, and we'll tell them where it came from, seeing your publication referenced and on display? Some of the publishers understand that and buy it, but some we do end up paying some royalties. But boy, if you could remove the sort of entropy generation of that third-party IP, this would be a much simpler and much less expensive activity. Vijay, you can even correct me. The question was, what is the role of the library if all of this information goes online? Now, maybe two things. I don't see us replacing the library. We, in fact, actually work very closely with the library through DSpace, but we think of this as separate from what we collect institutionally. But once it's up there, if people want to archive it, as in other institutions, as opposed to use it dynamically, it could become part of the library operation in the same sense that they're already struggling with electronic journals and other electronic material. But I don't see it as a big force of distortion of library activities. Thank you very much. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed our continuing coverage of the 2005 Seminars on Academic Computing Conference. If you have feedback or ideas about how we should shape our coverage, just email matt@educause.edu. If you're listening to this recording on a remote device, you can comment on this podcast and read entries from our ever-growing community of bloggers at connect.educause.edu. EDUCAUSE is a nonprofit association whose mission is to advance higher education by promoting the intelligent use of information technology. Engage, learn, network, and grow at EDUCAUSE.